We pick back up in John chapter 11. John chapter 11. Notice once again, verse 4, Jesus' statement that this sickness is not to death, but on behalf of the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. I think we addressed similarly previously the concept that some may be led to think that, well, Jesus wanted to linger and wait so that, you know, Jesus goes ahead and Jesus lets Lazarus die, or that actually, just as the man who was born blind, God caused him to be born blind for God's glory to be manifested. But we showed that Jesus did not, and God did not, cause the blindness of the man. Jesus is actually the one who brings sight to the man. And that's the same thing here. It was not that God caused this sickness to come upon Lazarus so that Lazarus would die. It was that sickness is going to be part of this life. And just as we find in Romans 5, verse 12, therefore as by one man sin entered into the world and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men for that all have sinned. Well, before death, what precedes death so many times is sickness, illness. And so you could actually say that sickness as a means to death, would we have ever been sick? Have we ever had that discussion? Would we have had sickness and illness and everything had sin not entered into the world? Well, in Romans 5, verse 12, we know that therefore as by one man sin entered into the world and death through sin. So that's what brought death into this world and perhaps sickness as well. So it's not God that, zapped Lazarus thinking, I just want to glorify myself, and so raising of Lazarus, so I'll cause him to be sick. No, that's not the right reading. No more than, God didn't cause the blindness. Blindness is going to be, sometimes it's going to be genetic. And it clearly wasn't due to sin. Neither this man nor his parents sinned that he was born blind. Jesus was going to use it as an occasion for the glorification of God. And so, then notice John chapter 11, verse 5. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Now, you're going to find a different word here for the word love. This is going to be the verb form of the noun that we know as agape. So, it would be agapao here in verse 5. Whereas, in verse 3, you have phileo, which would be the one you are fond of, whom you are fond of, is sick in essence. Now, you may read some that think that there's a great distinction here. But sometimes you're going to see that whether it's phileo or whether it's agape or agapao, you're going to see that it may just be kind of interchangeable and synonymous. Some will also take that concept into John chapter 21, which I think that there is a definite distinction there, because Peter is adamant in not using the same terminology Jesus is, because Jesus asks him, agapao, do you love me? And Peter, now he's devoid of his previous brashness, everybody forsakes you, I'm not going to forsake you, I'll die for you, And now it's not that. It does appear clearly as though he does not want to use the stronger term of love, which we usually just say agape. He say, I'm fond of you. I have great care and affection for you, phileo. And so that does seem to be a clear distinction, because Peter never, he does not use the stronger term agape. And then Jesus comes to his down to his level, and of course, three times to match the three times that he had denied Jesus. Here in John 11, whether you show a distinction or not, I'm not sure that that distinction is quite as clear in John 11. But Jesus clearly does have both the fondness, the affection, the deep care, as well as the genuine love. And so now notice you have verse 6. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed two more days in the place where he was. Now, where was the place that he was staying? Well, we just have to remember back into chapter 10. Chapter 10, verse 40. He went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was immersing at first, and there he stayed. And we talked about, well, was that John 1:28? Is that really a reference there? John 1:28, these things were done in Bethabara or Bethabara, which others will render it as, you know, Bethany, based upon, and that's what I would actually go with there, since both the Nestle UBS text, which is now known as the Greek New Testament, and the majority text both agree. And whenever that agreement takes place within those texts based upon manuscript evidence, I'd say the text is firm. And so I would actually go with Bethany in John 1:28. Bethany beyond Jordan where John was immersing. Or was this, as we discussed, John 3:23, that John was baptizing, immersing in Anon near Salim because there was much water there. So one of the, you know, I'm not sure, I don't know that we can with any distinction, but because it's given very generally, generically in John 10 verse 40, he went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was immersing at first, and there he stayed. That's the location, wherever exactly that is, whether Bethany, you know, I mean, if that's the case, then I mean, it doesn't seem like that's the case, though. So I would argue that it was John 3:23. Because if he's in Bethany, he's not there. If he, you know, so that really helps us to make the connection that John 10 verse 40, it wouldn't have been John 1:28 if we go with the variant Bethany. If we went with you might have a different argument if you talk about Bethabara. But otherwise, we're talking about baptizing in Anin, in Salem near Anin, because there was much water there. John 3, verse 23. In Anin, Anon, near Salim. And you may have different pronunciations on that. Notice then, you have in verse 6, stay two more days. And then notice what he says. After this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. That takes us back to passages like chapter 6, verse 6. Look at chapter 6, verse 6. Let us go back to Judea again. Why is he going to Judea? Well, he said this, whereas in this occasion, it was as a test, for he himself knew what he would do. So while he was testing Philip, Jesus knew what he would do, so that's why he's going to go to Judea again. He knows what he's going to do. It's not without rhyme or reason, as Ken just taught in the class. It's, you know, very orderly and really very specific rationale. Jesus knows what he's going to do. And then we need to hang on to verse 7, because then notice in verse 8, the disciples, you know, that's another statement and takes them back. Disciples said to him, Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again? Now, when you have this terminology of Judea, and then you have our translations rendering it as Jews, usually you would stick with Judea, Judeans. And the reason why is because it's the same word, can be rendered as Judeans, you know, generically, which doesn't necessarily mean specifically and only Jews. You know, it wasn't that, it was just completely 100% population of the Jews. That's not, this is not used in, and we're going to use the terminology of religious. Within the, you know, religious terminology, that's not what they're saying. They're talking generically as Judeans. It seems to be the case. And we made this case prior to this in chapter 7, verse 1, if you recall our discussion in chapter 7, verse 1. Notice chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea, because the, here we go, the Jews or Judeans sought to kill him. Well, Judea, when you have Judea, then you would usually render it as Judeans, not specifically as Jews. However, when we're continuing to look at, you know, putting all this together, then you would also notice that, well, of the Judeans, who was it specifically? And you look at chapter 10, verse 31. In chapter 10, verse 31, I would render it as the Jews. Then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Because we've been talking about the Pharisees. And so Pharisees are leading this. And yes, while they're Judeans, you would use more of the religious concept because of the Pharisees' involvement here. But you see the sense at which you might say, we might use terminology, use an exact word, same word in one context. We don't mean it specifically. We mean it generically. In another context, we mean it specifically. And so I that distinction is rarely pointed out. But just know that when you see Judea, as we saw in chapter 7, then don't think so specifically as you might in chapter 10, verse 31, the Jews took up stones again to stone him. It's the same Greek word, mind you, but when you have the concept of the region of Judea, and then you have the word that's translated as Jews, then keep it generic, as people of Judea, thus the Judeans. And so, and you'll see that, you know, at least like we said in John 7, and then once again here. And the reason we're going to point that out now is because it's going to occur once again in chapter 11 that we'll notice in just a bit. So they're shocked. Jews sought to, the Judeans sought to stone you. Are you going there again? You have a death wish? I mean, why are you wanting to go back? Don't you remember? Notice Jesus' response, verse 9. Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day?" And you know, we talk about the evening and the morning, first day. And he's talking about daylight. He's talking about daylight. Daylight time. "If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world." Well, we already know John 8, verse 12, John 9, 4, and 5. Who is the light of the world? Jesus is the light of the world. He made that. He was very emphatic about it. And so, Jesus is the light. You follow the light, you walk in the light. You walk in Jesus, you follow Jesus. Notice then, you have in John 11, verse 10, "If one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." Well, I've already mentioned, and we'll see this later on, that when Judas goes out, whenever he is going to do the dirty deed of betraying Jesus, what does the text tell us? He went out and it was it day? No, it was night. You know, and so we really are picking up on this contrast of night and day, light and darkness. And of course, with John's terminology, that is so significant because as you look, as we recall in 1 John, throughout 1 John, you can talk about and use as your, you know, outline pretty much that God is light, to outline the first part of 1 John, and then God is love. So in chapter 1, God is light, and notice the contrast there. God is light, and in him there is no darkness, none. And it's very emphatic in the Greek text. That's why you'll have there, in him there is no darkness at all, but I don't think that quite does service to there is no darkness, none. It's a complete and absolute denial. There's not one hint, not any bit at all of darkness within him. God is light. And then, of course, by John, 1 John chapter 4, it's expressed very clearly, as we already see concerning God, that he is love. It's specifically stated, 1 John 4:8, that God is love. God is light and God is love. And so here you have, Jesus says, John 11, verse 10, if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. Well, if the light's not in you, God's not in you. Greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And so, we too, as Jesus, you know, as you look at the teachings of Jesus, and when you look at Matthew, and you look at Luke, and what we call the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew, and it seems like it could actually be a case that you could, that Jesus would have repeated very similar things on perhaps different occasions, and so that you are the light of the world. Jesus is the light of the world. We're the light of the world. And so when we put all this terminology together about light, and then we reflect upon background, well, what does God talk about light? And your word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my path. And so we just make, you know, more connections about God's word provides the light and guides us. Jesus is guiding them. And Jesus is light and we're light. And without God's word abiding in us, there is no light. And we walk in darkness. Notice then you have John 12, verse 35 is a verse that we'll, you know, we're going to see in the next chapter. John 12, verse 35 along these lines, because notice the similarity of these statements. Jesus said to them, a little while longer the light is with you. Well, who's the light? Jesus. So Jesus is saying, I'm going to be with you a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. So, then he says, verse 36, while you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light. And so that helps connect with the concept of, if you're sons of light, then you are the light of the world. Notice now, verse 11, John 11, verse 11, these things he said, and after that, he said to them, our friend Lazarus sleeps. And of course, it's not foreign to us at all to see that sleep is used euphemistically for death. It seems to be a bit more foreign. This concept seems to be a bit more foreign to them because it's like they don't get it. So let's not take it from the perspective of, man, you know, were they just that dense? We can't approach it that way. Because this might not have been nearly the, use the old phraseology, the modern coin of terminology as it is with us. So don't think that, you know, that, man, they're just really, really slow. It's just that when we're in an environment and you talk about, well, you know, he fell asleep. And you know, in the context of he's no longer with us, we get that. As a matter of fact, I remember an older lady, she always referred to her husband, and his name was Freddie. And she said, well, when Freddie went away, my brother, we knew clearly what it meant that Freddie went away. She didn't say that, you know, he passed on and he went away. You know, it's not something we hear a lot of, but, you know, context. You know, before Freddie went away, and it was always Freddie went away. Well, we knew that Freddie didn't, you know, my brother said one time, he said, well, where did Freddie go? Well, he didn't need to say that. You know, we knew that Freddie was no longer, he went away out of this world. So, they don't pick up on that from Jesus' terminology. It wasn't something that, oh, he's saying that Lazarus is dead. Whereas if you hear somebody say that he's asleep. Then we're going to recognize that probably pretty readily. Jesus says, but I go that I may wake him up. So let's put it from their perspective. Okay, so Jesus is saying that this guy's asleep. They're taking him very literally. He's asleep, and we're going to take that trip and wake him up. But to our way of thinking, it's like, okay, well, he's asleep. We're going to wake him up. It's going to take a while to get there. Maybe he's in a coma. No, he's dead. Verse 12, then the disciples said, Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well. You know, hey, sleep is a good thing. Sleep helps us recover. And we were really glad Mark got 12 hours of sleep because it looked like he might not be able to make it today because he was getting sick. But he did. He got well because we were concerned that he wasn't looking too well before he got about 12 hours of sleep. And so I appreciate this statement and understand it even better now, that if he sleeps, he will get well. Essential for rest, recovery, and being able to, you know, bounce back in a fine fashion. Verse 13, however, Jesus spoke of his death. But see, this makes it clear that wasn't really common, especially whenever John gives this explanation. And it's standard terminology now about sleep and death being used interchangeably. But they thought that he was speaking about taking rest in sleep. Verse 14, then Jesus said to them plainly, once again, the same word, which would be publicly, he's saying this very clearly, Lazarus is dead. Notice verse 15. A lot of our translations are going to render this as, and I am glad for your sakes. This is your standard word, rejoice. Same word that Paul says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. You know, I don't know of any translation, not that there's not, but I don't know of any translation that says, be glad in the Lord. And again, I say be glad. So, to my way of thinking, I would actually just go ahead and render it as standard translation should be, you know, especially with consistency. I rejoice for your sakes that I was not there. Because that will help us, instead of just I'm glad, it just doesn't mean as much to us a lot of times. It just doesn't seem to be as concrete, maybe, at least to my way of thinking. When I read this as I rejoice for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. So Jesus is rejoicing, not just glad, but the word, I rejoice, what? Why is he rejoicing? Not because Lazarus is dead, but that they may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him. Notice then John 11:16. Then Thomas, and then you're going to have, if your translation has a transliteration, a letter-for-letter equivalent, you're going to have Thomas, who is also called Didymus. Others are going to translate, other translations will translate this, and then you'll have then Thomas, who is called the twin. But that's why you'll have, you know, Thomas, who's called Didymus in a number of translations, the twin and others, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. We find some insight about Thomas here, his commitment. And it does appear to be, it's like, you know, if Jesus isn't going to live and he's going to die, then I don't want to live either, and I want to die. And this is going to be the same Thomas that we're going to see later on, that, you know, he's in still just such a state of disbelief that Jesus is resurrected that he's calling for the evidence which Jesus finally presents to him. So very, very devout. But let's put it from what seems to clearly be their perspective. And why I say clearly seems to be their perspective all throughout this, especially Acts chapter 1, Lord, at this time you're going to restore the kingdom. You know, is this when you are going to show your power and your glory and, you know, finally give a crushing blow to Rome and the Roman Empire? And that seems to be their concept in Acts chapter 1 after the resurrection. And so with that, then it would be, you know, Jesus is the Messiah, and if this is going to be where the rebellion starts and where the battle begins, you know, I'm going to be on the front line with him. That may be the mentality. That at least seems like that's likely what he's talking about. So our time is gone. We're going to stop here, and this is a. If you look at your Bible, some will give a paragraph break with verse 17 so that we have a new paragraph. But we'll plan to talk more about this whole context. Now, Lord willing, we're going to have We're going to have a guest speaker, and John Arechiga that will be coming, friend of the Greers, and he's been here before visiting us, and he'll be here for the 21st. And so, preaching for Sunday morning. And so if you want to study in advance, he told me that in all likelihood, he's planning on giving a lesson concerning the prodigal son. So you might want to study Luke chapter 15 in preparation for John's arrival to preach. If you're here today to